Picture an apartment building in Vancouver, sometime in 2006. It is an old building with a narrow elevator at one end of the lobby, and the elevator has been broken again for about a week. The man who lives on one of the upper floors comes home from work in the evening, and he sees the out-of-service sign taped over the call button, and he sighs, and he takes the stairs. He has been taking the stairs a lot lately. He works at a software company, where he and his colleagues are responsible for one of the most widely used pieces of software in the world, a web browser, used by hundreds of millions of people. The browser is, by any reasonable measure, an extraordinary piece of engineering. But there is something about it that has been quietly grinding on him, the way the broken elevator has been grinding on him, and the two problems in his mind are beginning to feel related. The browser crashes. Not often exactly, but constantly. A user opens too many tabs, and one of those tabs runs a piece of code that does something unexpected with memory, and the whole browser collapses. Every quarter, the security team at the company files report after report about the same family of problems. A small piece of memory got freed too early, and another part of the program is still trying to read from it. A buffer holding text got asked to write past its end, and now it has overwritten data it should not have touched. Two parts of the program try to update the same piece of memory at the same time, and the result is corrupted. These are not exotic bugs. They're the bugs of every program written in the system's languages of the day. They are, to the engineers who write that code, the price of doing business. The man, walking up the stairs, has begun to wonder, quietly, whether the price has to be paid. He has a side project. It does not have a name yet that will stick. It is, for now, just a folder on his laptop full of half-formed ideas about a programming language that would, by its very design, refuse to compile code that contains those bugs. Not catch them at testing. Not catch them in production. Refuse to compile them. At all. Ever. With no exceptions. He has been thinking about this for years. He has been writing little prototypes in private. He has been telling almost no one. His name is Graydon Hoare. The folder on his laptop will eventually become Rust. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 4, The Rust Story. Today, I want to tell you where this language came from. Not in the dry dates and facts way that origin stories sometimes get told, but as a real story with a person in the center and a real frustration and a slow-burning idea and a company that decided to bet on it and a moment of release into the world that almost did not happen. By the end of this episode, you will understand why Rust exists at all, and you will understand why so many of the people who use it today seem to take it personally. It is a language with a backstory, and the backstory shapes the personality. Let me back up and set the scene properly. In the early 2000s, the company called Mozilla was responsible for a web browser called Firefox. Firefox was free, open source, and at one point used by something like a quarter of all internet users worldwide. It was the alternative to Internet Explorer, and millions of people loved it. It was also written in a language called C++, which we talked about briefly last episode. C++ is fast, and it is powerful, and it is the language that a great deal of large, serious software has been built in for decades. It is also, as we discussed, in the category of languages that put very little protection between you and the computer's memory. A skilled engineer can write beautiful, careful, fast code in C++. The trouble is that even skilled engineers, working carefully, leave gaps. The gaps become bugs. The bugs become crashes, and worse, security holes. Mozilla's security team kept a running record of these bugs. They were not subtle. They were the kind of bugs you read about in the news. A page on the open web could, through a flaw in the browser's memory handling, take over the user's computer. Memory that had been freed got read again. Buffers got written past their end. Parallel pieces of the program stepped on each other. Engineers fixed each one as it appeared, and another one always appeared. It was by some careful studies done at the time and since, somewhere around 2/3 of all the serious security vulnerabilities at Mozilla and at Microsoft and at Google and at every other large company writing software in the C family of languages. 2/3. Not a small problem. The dominant failure mode of an entire generation of software. There were many ways to react to this. The traditional way was to write better tools, more testing, stricter code review, larger security teams. People did all of those things for years, and the bugs kept coming. They kept coming because the deeper cause was not careless engineers. The deeper cause was the language itself, which made entire categories of mistakes easy and gave the engineer no help in avoiding them. Gradenhorst's idea, in the broken elevator apartment in Vancouver, was to react differently. He thought, what if there were a language that simply did not allow these mistakes? What if the rules of the language, the very grammar of it, made it impossible to write code that had the bug? Not impossible to compile and then catch at runtime. Impossible to compile in the first place. The language would refuse. It would say no, this code might dereference freed memory. Please fix it, and the engineer would fix it, and only correct code would ever be allowed to run. This sounded, at the time, somewhere between impossible and silly. Many smart people had thought about something like it. None of them had figured out how to do it without ruining the language's performance, or making the language so restrictive that no real program could be written in it. There were languages like the one called Haskell that came close, but they paid for it by being slow and by being unfamiliar to almost everyone who worked at the system's level. What Graydon wanted was something different. He wanted a language fast enough to write a browser engine in, but strict enough to refuse the bugs that browsers kept dying from. The folder on his laptop grew, slowly, over the years. He named the project Rust after a family of fungi he had read about, fungi that are extraordinarily robust, that have multiple redundant systems for survival that you genuinely cannot kill. He thought a language with that kind of redundancy, that kind of refuse-to-die quality, should carry the name. The name stuck. By 2009, Mozilla had noticed. They were searching for a way out of the C++ trap themselves. They began to officially sponsor Graydon's work, hired a small team to work on alongside him, and treated the project not as a side experiment, but as a long-term bet. The bet was simple. If Rust ever became real, Mozilla could rewrite the most performance-critical pieces of the browser in it, and the bug list would shrink. They were betting their browser's future on the side project that had once lived in a folder on a single laptop. To prove that the bet was worth making, Mozilla started a second project, in parallel, called Servo. Servo was an experimental browser engine, built from scratch in a new language, to test whether Rust could actually do the work it was supposed to do. The two projects fed each other. When Servo found something that was hard to express in Rust, the language designers changed Rust to make it easier. When Rust gained a new feature, Servo would try to use it and either find the feature good or find it broken and report back. For years, the two projects grew together. Neither one finished, each one teaching the other. The work was slow. Programming languages are, by their nature, slow to design. Every decision shapes every later decision. The team made choices and unmade them and remade them. Some of those early choices look strange today because the language went through several large redesigns before it settled. The borrow checker, which is the part of Rust that does the careful checking of memory rules, took years to evolve into the form it has today. There were green threads, and there were classes, and then there were not because the team kept finding that the choices they had made were the wrong ones for what they were actually trying to build. If you read the early posts from the team, you can feel the strain of it. They were not trying to invent a new language for the sake of inventing a new language. They were trying to solve a specific problem, and they kept discovering that the solution they had reached for would also force them to give up something else they cared about, and they would back up and try again. Most language design happens this way, in private, behind closed doors, with a single visionary holding the line on a coherent design. Rust's design happened in public, on mailing lists and in code review threads, with hundreds of people weighing in. That openness made the design slower, but it also made the design better, because every weak idea got argued out of the language before it could harden into something permanent. By 2012, the language had a recognizable shape. By 2014, it was close to ready for the world. And then, on a day in May of 2015, Mozilla released the first stable version, Rust 1.0, and made a promise that sounded almost outrageous at the time. They said, "This language will catch the entire family of memory bugs at compile time. It will be as fast as C. It will have no garbage collector. And, starting today, the syntax and the core guarantees will not change in any backward incompatible way ever again. We are committing to this, and you can build on it." Almost nobody believed them. That is not a metaphor. If you go back and read the technical conversations from the time, you will find serious, careful engineers across the industry treating the 1.0 announcement as a kind of academic curiosity. There are languages that promised safety and were slow. There are languages that promised speed and were dangerous. The idea that a single language could do both at the same time in a way that real programmers would put up with was the kind of claim that had been made before by people who turn out to be wrong. The reasonable assumption was that Rust was probably one more in a long line of overpromises. The first few years after that release were quiet. A few enthusiasts adopted Rust. A few brave companies tried it in production. Most of the world looked at it, saw the strict borrow checker, ran into the famous error messages that say no, gently, you cannot do this, and here is exactly why, and decided that the price was too high. It was a curiosity. It was a research project that escaped the lab. It was, to be honest, not yet winning. And then, slowly, that began to change. The companies that did try Rust started reporting back from their experiments. Their software was faster than the equivalent in Go. It was safer than the equivalent in C++. Their tail latencies, the slowest moments of their services, the moments their users actually noticed, were tighter. The crashes that had plagued their old code bases simply stopped happening. The language was not a curiosity. It was, quietly, the answer to a question many of them had given up on. A new generation of database, of network proxy, of operating system component, started being written in it. The wave was small at first, and then it was not small, and then, almost without anyone announcing it, it became one of the most important shifts in how serious software gets built. We will spend next time digging into exactly how that wave broke, and where, and at which companies, and what numbers came out the other side. It is one of the better adoption stories in modern computing, and it is worth telling slowly. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that Rust was born from frustration. A particular engineer, in a particular apartment, with a particular set of bugs in front of him that he was tired of seeing. The language exists because somebody decided the bugs did not have to be the price of doing business. The second is that Mozilla, a company that depended on C++ for its survival, was willing to bet on the experiment of a single engineer and let it grow into a real product and then give it away to the world. Almost no company does that anymore. And the fact that Mozilla did it then is worth remembering. The third is that the 1.0 promise, the promise that Rust would catch the entire family of memory bugs without a garbage collector and without slowing down, was an absurd promise when it was made, and it has turned out to be true. Next time on Rust, gently, we will talk about what happened after 1.0. The early years of doubt, the slow conversion, and then the avalanche. We will name the companies. We will give you the numbers. We will explain, with some honesty, why every major technology company you have heard of is now running Rust somewhere in production, why the Linux kernel did something in 2022 that it had refused to do for 30 years before that, and what all of that means for the future of how serious software gets built. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.